It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about what led up to Donald Trump's election last November and how that connects or does not connect with what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend. With me to discuss the current state of affairs is New York Times columnist Brett Stevens. Hi there, Brett.
Nice to hear from you, Celeste.
Also with us is Carol Anderson, professor and chair of African American Studies at Emory University. Her latest book, White Rage, examines this widening racial divide in America. And still with us is Jared Yates Sexton. He's an author and professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University. Hello, Jared, again, and hello, Carol.
Hi, Celeste.
Hello.
Brett, I want to start with you because Jared is... I think avowedly liberal. I mean, that's fair, Jared, right, to say that you're on the liberal end of the spectrum?
I think that's fair to say.
Okay. And so, Brett, you're on the conservative side. Jared is making...
I'm not sure what that means anymore, but go ahead. Yeah.
I was hoping you would explain it, but let's talk about some of the connections people are making. And let me ask you the same question I asked Jared, which is it fair to blame Donald Trump for what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend?
I'm not sure if it's fair to blame the president for what happened in Charlottesville, but there's no question in my mind that the Trump campaign and the president himself, if you will, sort of lifted the lid on a sewer, and it came erupting out. And what you're seeing in Charlottesville is a piece of that. I mean, the president began legitimizing, in my view, some extraordinarily hateful rhetoric, normalizing a whole set of bigotries, which I thought some of us had hoped had sort of been cast to the very far fringes of society. And he brought them that much closer to the center. So in that sense... you don't want to blame someone for the act of one crazed guy, but there's a connection.
So, Carol, let me then play you a couple takes here on what's happening. The first one is just a portion of Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe's statement following Saturday's events. This was recorded by the Washington Post.
I remind you all that we are a nation of immigrants. Unless you're Native American, the first ships that came to Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. And since that time, many people have come to our great country to unite us. Our diversity, that mosaic tile of immigrants, is what makes us so special. And we will not let anybody come here and destroy it. So please go home and never come back.
Okay. Although they have to go home to somewhere in the United States. the second clip is from the CNN's interview with White House aide Tom Bossert. He is Trump's Homeland Security advisor.
These were people who showed up intentionally looking for trouble. These weren't people that showed up to protest a statue. I'm sure there were good people in the group that had various opinions on the removal or maintenance of the statue. But what they found when they showed up were groups from outside that showed up on both sides looking for trouble.
You're shaking your head, Carol. What do you make of this idea that we're talking about a small group of troublemakers on both sides?
That's a false equivalency. What we had was a militarized group of white supremacists who came to show their strength that they were going to take their country back and use the statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, as a symbol of what they were going to do to, in fact, flex the muscle that the president had in fact been signaling to them was absolutely okay. And let me just say this false equivalency of the counter-protesters were not armed. The counter-protesters weren't the ones that the police were afraid of, had better weapons than they did.
Jared, your book discusses a lot about rage, this rage that is in some cases just sort of boiling up. And yet that same type of rage is something that people described helped to fuel Bernie Sanders' campaign. Is it a false equivalency to compare those two types of anger?
Well, I certainly saw a fair amount of anger from Bernie Sanders' base. Actually, at the Democratic National Convention, I watched them riot. I watched them threaten delegates going into the convention. So there were moments of rage, particularly on the left. But it was a lot smaller and less focused and less racist and xenophobic anger. It was more about the process. There's certainly been these instances of violence. They've certainly met a lot of these white supremacists, whether it's in Berkeley or in, I believe, Portland and now in Charlottesville. They've certainly met and had these small skirmishes. But these white supremacists basically have paramilitary groups now. They are training. They are openly admitting that they are going to these places to provoke violence. And I think that one is a reaction and the other is provocation.
So, Brett, I have this tweet from Doug Patton in Southwest Georgia who says, radical white supremacists found a safe space inside the GOP during 2016. It's only Trump who allows them to stay in the nest. What do you make, Brett, of this idea that what we are seeing is the fruition of the Southern strategy crafted all those years before by Nixon and his aides?
I don't buy that narrative simply because if you actually look at the Nixon administration's record on civil rights and that of subsequent Republican administrations, I don't think I don't see a chain between at least the Nixon presidency. I won't talk about his election in '68 and the present. I think Trump represents a real discontinuity from the conservative movement that I used to belong to. But there's no question that from the gentleman or the person who tweeted that's exactly right what Trump did, which is to say that he made a whole set of views, a whole set of bigotries, whether it was with respect to Muslims or Mexicans or women or other more individualized prejudices, more targeted prejudices, he made them palatable. He made them okay. And so that's exactly right. It created this sort of safe space in which people like, Spencer,
Richard Spencer,
Felt that he could, that he in a sense benefited from a kind of wink and nod relationship with the president and certain members of the administration. If you read this new book about Steve Bannon by Joshua Green called The Devil's Bargain, you'll see that Bannon was very inclusive when it came to the uglier elements of the alt-right and using them for tactical purposes. Whether the alliance was tactical or ideological, one will find out. But it certainly opened up that space where these people feel like they are no longer at the fringes of society.
And yet, Brett, we have this tweet from Ted Barfield, and it's about you. He was protesting that you're not a bona fide conservative and says, quote, not really all that conservative, kind of David Brooks or Jennifer Rubin conservative, unquote. And this is a difficulty, especially for journalists, that at some point, how are we supposed to parse out who's a conservative voice and who isn't? It appears that in some people's minds, as soon as you criticize the Trump administration, you're no longer considered conservative.
Well, I think the real ideological divide, not just in this country, but in the West at large, I'm speaking to you from Germany, where I now live much of the time, isn't really between liberal and conservative in the old sense. It's between liberal and illiberal, if you will. That's to say that, yeah, I mean, I'm 100% in favor of the First Amendment. I'm liberal in some social senses. If anyone had read my columns in the Wall Street Journal about Obama administration policy, whether it was the Iran deal or any other number of subjects, they wouldn't have. They probably would have thought of me as falling on the conservative side of the spectrum. But when it comes to Trump, he has. Flirted with a form of politics which I don't recognize as genuinely conservative. I recognize it as illiberal in the sense that it's not a respecter of the freedom of the press. It's not a respecter of freedom of religion. All those traditional freedoms that used to bind Americans of both political or all political persuasions, even if we differed on, you know, taxes and foreign policy and other issues. So I don't know what he, I mean, I have I don't know if I'm a David Brooks conservative. I try to just think for myself. But I used to be a conservative who was for smaller government, less regulation, fewer taxes, and so on. I still am. It's just the Republican Party that increasingly under Trump I don't recognize.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Brett Stevens, columnist for the New York Times, also Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory, and Jared Yates Sexton, professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern. Carol, let me play you a comment from Barack Obama. He was speaking with CBS here. This is earlier. He is warning Trump and his administration not to break away from certain traditional practices in government.
The one thing I've said to him directly, and I would advise my Republican friends in Congress and supporters around the country, is just make sure that as we go forward, certain norms, certain institutional traditions don't get eroded, because there's a reason they're in place.
Carol, how do we weigh the distrust of government, which is kind of what Barack Obama is referring to there, and is felt across the political spectrum, with kind of what we're seeing when these norms and traditions break down?
And I think what you have here, this I would push back a bit on Brett Stevens, because it was in that moment of the Southern strategy where you started getting the tenets of what we're seeing erupting in Trump. So that this is a long time building. And Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann wrote a brilliant book. It's even worse than it looks.
A conservative and a liberal, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's even worse than it looks, because what they're talking about is what has happened to the Republican Party. And part of what has happened to the Republican Party is that the toxin of racism, white supremacy, was invited in via the Southern strategy and began to take over more and more and more, to the point where those kinds of traditional Republicans, those who valued small government, fiscal responsibility, and civil rights, where they no longer had a place because they couldn't get through the primary because of the toxin of white supremacy there. So you're seeing more and more of a push playing to that rabid, energized base of the Republican Party. And this is why you'll get a John McCain who has to bring on a Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate. And this is what laid the groundwork for Trump. And a key element in that norm shifting is, in fact, the role of government, because government was seen as being instrumental in implementing civil rights. And so there is a problem with government.
Jared, Carol's book was called White Rage. Your book is very much focused on rage. But the issue for me is that, how does one address rage? I mean, rage is inherently illogical, right? And emotional. How does one deal with it?
That's a wonderful question. And I wish that I had a succinct, proven answer to deal with that question. The only thing that I know is that when I'm talking to my relatives, when I'm talking to my family, when I'm talking to people from my community back in Indiana, I have to talk to them on a personal level. I have to bridge the gap of ambiguity. I have to let them know, for instance, with these neo-Nazis, that they have threatened me. They have threatened my family. They have done these awful things. And once you put a human face on the situation, and particularly a face of someone they know, it makes a difference. But on a larger scale in this country, we have a lot of problems, economic, social, political, that we're not having real conversations about the roots of these things, because they're very difficult and they're very nuanced. And we're living in a soundbite culture in which most people want an easy and direct answer. And the easiest and most direct answer is to be angry. And once people start pointing out who to be angry at, that takes care of the conversation. And so as a result, we have to have these difficult, nuanced conversations. But how we do that is a great question.
Brett, let me let you answer that same question. Not to get a soundbite for you or an easy direct answer, but if rage is what's fueling what we're seeing right now, and it appears as though without some action, it could very easily get worse, what do we do?
Well, look, you know, I mean, I'm always moved by Lincoln's first inaugural address, which concludes with that beautiful peroration, calling on us to summon the better angels of our nature. And typically, it has been the role of statesmanship in the United States to do exactly that. You think of George W. Bush in the immediate wake of 9/11, reaching out to the Muslim community, making sure that it would not be targeted and stereotyped, and that he wouldn't lead a crusade against Islam. Now it's more difficult because you just don't have that kind of administration. You have an administration that is sort of leaning on surrogates to make the right sounding noises while the president is absent without leave. I think it's very important not just for former presidents like Barack Obama, but also for the two former president, the two Bushes, and other senior Republican figures who have honorable records when it comes to matters of civil rights and calling out bigots on the right and on the fringes of the Republican Party for sort of claiming the Republican Party for themselves. Yeah. And if the president isn't going to do it, it's vital that voices on the right do that. So far, I think they have, but it's very difficult when you're dealing with a president who is constantly flirting with not the better angels of our nature, but with our very worst instincts. It's a depressing verdict, but that's why I was opposed to Trump from the beginning and remain appalled by his presidency today.
That's Brett Stevens, columnist for The New York Times. Also, Jared Yates Sexton, author and professor at Georgia Southern, and Carol Anderson of Emory University. Her latest book is White Rage, and the paperback hit shelves on April 5th. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.